Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day. We want you, yes, you, to join the Behind the Knife team as a surgical education fellow. We're looking for enterprising surgical residents to take the bull by the horns and build something new and exciting. Fellows will benefit from ample support from the Behind the Knife team, including the use of our digital education platform and access to all of our resources like illustrators, video editing, AI tools, social media, and more. Get your name out there and build your CV by being part of the number one surgery education platform in the world. We're offering a two-year fellowship starting in July 2026 and ending in June 2028. Only residents beginning their two-year academic development time will be considered. Check out the show notes for more information, including the application link. All applications are due on April 20th. Again, all applications are due by April 20th. Now, get out there and dominate the day. Welcome back to Behind the Knife. On March 27th, 2026, the House Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on the Administrative State, Regulatory Reform, and Antitrust released an interim staff report titled Medical Mismatch: How a Residency Hiring Monopoly Harms Patients, Doctors, and the American Public. We've pulled out three tasty quotes from the report to get this pod started. The first: medical institutions created the match so that residency programs would not have to compete as hard as they would have otherwise in a free market. The next: the match severely constrains competition, resulting in feeble wage growth and inflating expenses for medical residents. And the third: the match has stripped medical residents of any semblance of bargaining power and artificially depresses wages. So ostensibly, this report is the product of a year-long investigation that pulled over 1,500 documents from standard-setting organizations like the DMC, NRMP, ACGME, etc., and from a number of teaching hospitals. And they transcribed interviews with two physicians who went through the system. And the report's central claim is that the NRMP exercises monopolistic control over residency hiring, and that this control causes concrete measurable harm. So to talk about this, I'm joined by Drs. Emma Burke and Dr. Agnes Premkumar, both surgical education fellows at Behind the Knife with an interest in surgical education and this very topic. So we're also joined by a special guest, Dr. Brian Carmody. He is a pediatric nephrologist at the Children's Hospital of the King's Daughter in Norfolk, Virginia. He's also an associate professor of pediatrics at the Old Dominion University Virginia Health Sciences Center, where he teaches the second year kidney module and serves as an associate program director for the pediatric residency program. However, he's probably best known as an analyst and commentator on medical education as his social media alter ego, the Sheriff of Sodium. I love the name. And he's provided detailed commentary and high-level understanding of the match process, which we at Behind the Knife have followed closely on social media. Brian, welcome. What's your alter ego, the Sheriff of Sodium, all about?
Well, thank you for having me, Patrick. I guess I could tell the story a couple of different ways, but the shortest version is that once I started talking about medical education on social media, I wanted a place to put more durable content so it wasn't just sort of swept up in the current of daily events. And believe it or not, the domain name, the Sheriff of Sodium, was actually available, and so I snatched it up. But it was a nickname I'd gotten for different reasons back in residency. And so, yeah, he is I and I am him.
This is a nephrology humor at its best.
Right, exactly.
So there's so much to talk about with this report. The most important thing we want to cover on this podcast is to make sure that our listeners, the vast majority of which are surgeons or kind of surgery adjacent, understand that this report is out there because it's generated a lot of discussion, some consternation, et cetera. And so we'll start with the first few questions framing this report, learning a little bit more about what's in it. And then we'll dive into details about some of the key topics when it comes to things like residency, salary, unionization, et cetera. So first and foremost, Brian, why was the investigation performed? And should Congress be involved and or interested at this point in investigating the match?
Yeah, those are good questions. And I like to think I know a lot about the match, but I mean, I can sort of only speculate about why Congress took this issue up now. A couple of years ago, there was a congresswoman from Indiana that proposed a bill to repeal the statutory exemption that allows the match to be immune from any sort of antitrust claim. And at that time, actually, that congresswoman, some of her staffers reached out to me because I've talked about this issue, and I spoke with them, and I was very curious what her motivation for putting forth that legislation, which never got out of committee, was. And they characterized it to me as just sort of a small government, good business, peel down the guardrails kind of interest. That congresswoman was on the Judiciary Committee for two terms and then stepped off for this current Congress, which is when this came up. So I sort of wonder if that was the seed that got this planted. I mean, certainly antitrust is specifically in the purview of the House Judiciary Committee. I mean, it's actually, I mean, they have a specific subcommittee on that topic. So they're certainly well within their rights to re-examine this issue. But I honestly don't know exactly why it came up now.
Yeah. And you mentioned Section 207 specifically. So going back in time, and I'd highly recommend anyone listen to this podcast to look up, and we'll provide a link for it in the show notes, Dr. Carmody's 6-part YouTube series. They're about 20 minutes or so each on the match from the history through the current day. It's phenomenal. It's super great content. Really enjoyed listening to it. So that provides a lot of the backdrop. But it's critical for us to talk about Section 207 and the Jung lawsuit. Can you inform everyone, what is that? When did that happen? And why is it important to the discussions that we're having now and what's happening in this report?
Yeah. So I guess as a primer for anyone who's unaware of the sort of relevant history here, I guess we live in a country where, in general, you're not allowed to corner the market on something and then drive up prices or run out your competitors or things like that. I mean, we have multiple pieces of legislation going back over 100 years that sort of preclude that kind of behavior, like the Sherman Antitrust Act. Well, the match system, the medical match system, as you all know, sort of came about in the 1950s and strengthened and evolved in the years afterwards. And in the late 1990s, early 2000s, it attracted the scrutiny of attorneys with experience in antitrust litigation. And they sort of stumbled onto the fact that the way that these residency positions were assigned is not how it is in the free market. And residents' inability to negotiate their contract, you get matched and you sort of accept the contract sight unseen, didn't seem like it would be legally permissible. And so there was a big class action lawsuit that was filed in the federal court in Washington, D.C., and alleging that the match violated the Sherman Antitrust Act. And not only naming as defendants in this lawsuit, not only naming the NRMP and the MC and the ACGME, but also naming individual hospitals, big academic medical centers that trained residents. And so you had a lot of deep-pocketed defendants who were very much at risk if the plaintiffs could show that this was an anti-competitive price-fixing scheme. And one of key allegations of the lawsuit, which, you know, comes up throughout the report, was that the existence of this match suppressed resident salaries. Anyway, like with any lawsuit like that, the defendant's first move was to try to get the suit dismissed. And so there was a lot of litigation toward that end. And ultimately, the central claims of the lawsuit survived, so that this was something that was headed for trial. And then came this Section 207 addendum to an unrelated piece of legislation. It was actually a piece of legislation of all things about how to fund pension equity. So a completely unrelated bill that right before it came up for a vote had an amendment that specifically made the match off limits for any sort of antitrust proceeding. And at the time, a number of senators spoke out against it, but this piece of legislation needed to be passed. And so ultimately it got passed in. And of course, the reason that this occurred, which may be something that we'll get back to later in the podcast, is that hospitals are very important and deep-pocketed constituents for many politicians. And so when they were threatened, they went to their friends in Congress and they got this amendment passed. So from that point on, I mean, that effectively ended the lawsuit and immunized the match against antitrust claims until the present day when, you know, now Congress is asserting that they're going to reexamine that issue.
Super sneaky. It's a wild piece of history. And so, right, that lawsuit had merits, right? Again, it was, I think, litigated to be able to proceed for a year or two or more. So it certainly had merits. And then after that Section 207 was added on, it was immediately dropped, correct?
Yeah, correct. I mean, Congress had spoken. The law had changed. The law had, Congress had specifically said, this is off limits, and the judge accordingly dismissed the suit. But yeah, I mean, at the very least, all of these hospitals would have gone through expensive litigation, and they were under real threat. By law, damages for antitrust are tripled to provide a disincentive from big companies trying to just stonewall and say, well, whatever, if somebody gets us on antitrust, we'll just pay back whatever we took in the first place. No, it gets tripled. So, I mean, this would have been devastating. It would have completely, had the plaintiffs prevailed, it would have been a big blow. Certainly would have ended the NRMP and probably the other alphabet soup medical regulatory bodies involved. But also, it would have been very damaging for academic medical centers.
So then thinking about how we got from that to now today, where we're kind of revisiting this topic of, is the match a monopoly? Is it a price fixing scheme? A lot of the language in that report was like pretty abrasive up front. Like clearly they're against what is happening right now with the match. Is there anything that the report gets right? And does that rhetoric kind of outrun the evidence?
Yeah, that's a good question. In my opinion, the match is anti-competitive. I think it has elements that certainly function to reduce competition. But I think that's a separate question than, is the match a good system for society? That's a bit of a separate issue.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about how it benefits society as the match. Like, as a current resident, I can't imagine going through another process. Like, this is, I expected to be involved in this when I applied to medical school. So overall, what does the match provide for our communities and our hospitals that we can't get otherwise?
Yeah, let's think about the benefits of the match. I mean, so one is that positions are allocated very efficiently. Residency programs, they, whatever, you spend some money on a website, or certainly you still have some recruiting expenses, but it's not like you're having to hire headhunters or get on ZipRecruiter or, I don't know, program. I mean, it'd be unheard of for programs to have to fill their spots that way. At the same time, that makes things efficient for applicants. You don't have to decide what order you're going to interview in or entertain offers. You get to consider all the possible offers that you might have had, rank them in your order of preference, and then get the best possible one for you. So, and when I say that it's an efficient system, I don't even mean in sort of the senses that I've alluded to before. As people probably know, the matching algorithm, it gives you the best possible outcome that you could have gotten. And not just you, but everyone else too. If you did not match to a program that you had ranked more highly, it's because they liked someone else more than you. So that's a hard truth, but you could not allocate people more efficiently than the matching algorithm currently does.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And another focus in the report is low wages for residents, particularly, I think, the comparison between advanced practice providers, how much they earn, and attending physicians. A lot of language is centered around basically doing the same amount of work for the low wages. So do we think that accurately captures those relationships in the healthcare field?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. Yeah, to be honest, I thought that was sort of one of the most, I don't know, disingenuous parts of the report. I'm trying to find the exact language right here because, as I think it's important. But you're right, there was testimony, which again, as Patrick said, came from exactly two physicians who have been through the matching process. And one of them asserted that the work they were doing as a senior resident was the same as what they did as an attending. And in a way, that's true. If you're viewing it through the eyes of the person doing the work, I rounded on the patients, I made the decisions, I did most of the procedure, whatever. But it's also true that you're a different kind of thing once you finish residency than before. And so maybe there's a sort of a ship of Theseus problem here about when exactly. And of course, if you're the person going through residency, you're continuously improving and you become an attending and it's not a discrete change, but legally there's a big change. You now assume the liability and you now have credentials that a resident doesn't have. And so I think you see this in many other markets many other things. You're one type of thing and then you're another, and there's different pay for those things. The PhD student writing their thesis may be doing the same research as the mentor, but it's a different kind of thing. In the area where I work, a lot of people work in the shipyards. When you're an apprentice, you make a certain thing. Once you're a master, you make something else. So I think that's a little bit disingenuous. And the comparison to nurse practitioners is somewhat relevant, because in many ways, hospitals can use nurse practitioners and physician assistants to fill the clinical roles that residents are doing. But in a way, it's not exactly an honest comparison, because a nurse practitioner, certainly they make more than a resident, but they don't make more than an attending, at least an attending in that field. So if you want to be a nurse practitioner or physician assistant, you certainly can. But your earnings potential will be sort of capped at the level that's cited in the report. It doesn't continue to grow. If you're the anesthesiologist instead of the nurse's anesthetist, then you make less as a resident, but you make more as an attending. And that's sort of part of the way the system works. So I felt like those are not really honest examples, but even everything I just said sort of sidesteps the main thrust of the report, which I don't know, maybe this is something we should start talking about now, is whether the match suppresses resident salaries. Because I'll be honest, I'm very skeptical that that's the case.
Right. We'll have to get to that, because ultimately this report conflates many things, and that's the bottom line. But sticking on this resident wages for a minute, certainly I think we'd all agree that making 60 and 70K a year for many years is not ideal, but it's also part of a bargain, though. Like you said, it's like this apprenticeship model. You buy in, you learn, you grow, and then at the end of the training, you make more. Now, there's a lot of commentary that can be said about where physician salaries are going, and that's a whole separate discussion. But, Brian, where do resident salaries come from? Another big question, right? Because when we talk about this report conflating things, you talk about like the role of GME, the federal government, even in setting these funding for GME programs. And this doesn't even touch the recent changes to student loans and opportunities for low-cost loans, et cetera. So there's a lot there, but pick up, where do you want to start with that?
Well, yeah, we could talk about resident salaries, but I guess first I want to sort of emphasize for any listeners, when you look at the report, I think few of us would say like everything in medical training or the healthcare system is great, like everything's perfect. There's a lot of problems. And this report certainly alludes to a lot of problems about the way that residents are treated, or about the way that some people, some patients struggle to access care. But I think the question is, how much of that is attributable to the match? So I wanted to sort of emphasize your point there. But yeah, resident salaries. So the bottom line, I guess, is that resident compensation can come from any source. Dollars are fungible, but most residency positions in the United States are heavily subsidized by the federal government. So one element of history that's overlooked by the report is how we got resident salaries in the first place. And you all may know, even my use of the term salary makes some people in academic medicine bristle, because the older term was stipend. And that was because if you go back to the oldest days of residency training, residents weren't really compensated at all. They lived in the hospital and they got trained, and that was their compensation. They literally lived in the hospital, and so that was how they were paid. And they got a small stipend to cover living expenses while they were doing that. And that was the model that we had. As residency programs expanded and hospitals grew bigger and you had more residents, especially at programs in Boston and New York, it started to become impractical to have all the residents living in the hospital. That, and also the nature of medical trainees was changing too. 80, 100 years ago, everybody was an unmarried man, as some of the mythical forefathers of residency training would not take a resident if they were married. They felt they wouldn't be adequately committed to their training. So you had residents who came in and they were married. They didn't want to live in the hospital. They had families. You're not living in the hospital. So, and like I said, hospitals were running out of space. So they began to provide a stipend that was larger in exchange for what they would have provided in room and board. And so that's how we got this base level of resident compensation, which has really only grown at the rate of inflation ever since. Now, in the 1960s, Medicare, began to pay components of resident training because it was, well, actually, I guess I should back up. Before Medicare even did it, private insurers would sometimes pay a small portion onto the fees that they were paying hospitals for the care that was provided to residents. And so when Medicare became a dominant insurer, they began to do the same thing. And they said, we'll subsidize resident training insofar as it's a public good and it's the right thing to do. We'll subsidize resident training in proportion to this new Medicare insurance program. And they intended this to be a temporary solution. But of course, an entitlement like that's hard to ever pull back. So they began providing what's called direct graduate medical education funding. And so if you train residents, you get a payment that's prorated based on the amount of Medicare patients that your hospital takes care of and the amount of your resident FTEs. But that payment is intended to offset the training costs of the residents, to pay the program director, to pay the resident's salary and cover some of their benefits. So most resident positions are subsidized by these DGME payments. And then later on in the 80s and 90s and since, as Medicare payment systems have evolved, there's been a new payment, this indirect medical education payment, which gets tacked on to the, you know, DRG-related payments that Medicare provides to the hospitals. So there's an additional funding stream, again, that's proportionate to the amount of Medicare patients that your hospital takes care of and your number of FTE residents, the cap that you're allowed. So many resident positions probably have federal subsidy that exceeds the amount of money that's paid to the resident, even inclusive of their costs and the space that they need and the program director and their benefits and so on. So there is a generous funding stream for residents. Now, having said that, one thing that gets kicked around a lot on social media is, but the residents, there's a cap on residencies. And that's sort of true, but not in the way that it's often talked about or seemingly understood on social media. So time was when if you created a residency position, well, guess what? You could have it federally subsidized. And in that environment, why wouldn't you have a residency position? For crying out loud, you get access to cheap labor. The government's going to cover it. Give me a residency. It doesn't matter if we need that residency position. It doesn't matter if someone qualified is going to take it. Every hospital would certainly want to do that. And it's expensive too. So that sort of reached a crisis point in the 1990s. And so that as part of the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, there was a cap on the number of GME positions that Congress would fund at that level. And so if your hospital was training residents in that era, well, however many you were training then, that's what your cap is. If you have a hospital that was not training residents, that has never trained residents, you can still actually access that. You just have to build up your cap based on however many residents you train in your first 5 years. And there are high-priced consultants that will help your hospital figure out how to do this as rapidly and financially beneficially as possible. However, even if your residency, even if you're operating at your cap, there's nothing keeping you from making more residency portions. You just got to pay for it some other way, which again, like I say, dollars are fungible. So residents certainly provide financial benefits well beyond what they're paid. And it's going to be a better than break-even proposition for hospitals almost all the time. And so unsurprisingly, even with this cap, the number of residency positions has continued to grow.
Right. And so the government has its hand in this process through Medicare GME caps, ACGME accreditation, et cetera, et cetera. But coming back to this report, this is again focusing on the match. And we talked about this conflation. So is there any contribution of the match to this wage gap, you think itself, or are we really talking about different structural features that some of which you just went through? And also, can you make a comment, another you talked about on social media things flying around this, I think it was New Mexico, where a neurosurgery residency was disbanded, and then this famous of how many APPs it took to replace them, and looking at salary through that lens too.
Yeah, right. I guess I could say a lot of things about this. So first of all, the wage gap as cited in the report, the fact that when you're an attending, you make a lot of money. When you're a resident, you make a little. I don't think that changes if you do away with the match. I really don't think that it does, because I'm of the opinion that resident salaries won't change. And the reason that an attending physician makes more, it has to do with like all the things that I said before. You're one type of person when you finish residency. You're a different type of person on June 30th, the day before you finish residency, even if in terms of your skill or even what you're doing on a day-to-day basis, even if it's the same on July 1st and June 30th, you're a different kind of person. And that's really what explains that gap. Now, the New Mexico thing that you're mentioning, so this is sort of a useful, I mean, it's anecdotal, but it's a very instructive sort of case study in the value of a resident. Because like I say, the government subsidizes GME heavily. And you can look up how much a given institution received. It's still a little bit hard to tell. There's a lot of calculations that go into this. The prorating and adjustments that get made by CMS rules for where in the country you are and stuff. So it's a little bit more hard to put a precise number on a given hospital, a given resident, how much is received for that person. It can be a little bit trickier than you might think. And so sometimes people debate, well, the University of New Mexico provided a very useful real-life case study when their neurosurgery program lost accreditation. And so all of a sudden you had neurosurgery residents who were providing all of this care, and then you didn't. And when they were replaced by nurse practitioners and physician assistants, it took, and I don't remember the figure off the top of my head, it was in the neighborhood of 2 or 3 to 1. And the cost was something similar. It was several multiples of what it would have taken to have the residents. So, and that's, you know, even neglecting any subsidy available. So I think it's a case study that shows that residents provide valuable service. And I'll leave it, I guess, at that for now.
Yeah. And so do you have a sense, again, let's just say in 2026, the vast majority of residents, and the report makes note of, it doesn't really matter what specialty you're in, everyone's making the same, no matter what that specialty pulls in terms of revenue for the hospital. But let's just say we're at like 60 to 80K for residents across their training time. Is there some kind of back of a napkin type math that you have seen about how much funding a hospital gets or an institution gets and how much they're paying? Are we talking, are they, is it double, triple? If you do confront institutions, I've seen a few articles about this, they talk about the funds outside of just the salary itself when it comes to healthcare, when it comes to these other costs. Can you provide us a little more information on that? Because I think that's something that a lot of people are interested in knowing.
Yeah, like I said, the figures are a little bit hard to interpret, but you can look them up. I mean, there's a spreadsheet you can pull from a federal website, which I've done before, and you can look and see how much each hospital received for training its residents. You can see the DGME payment and the IME payment, and you can look and sort of figure out how many residents there are trained at that hospital and divide and get a crude estimate. So you certainly can do that. When you take all comers, and I have a video on this topic, but I don't recall the exact figure. It's over six figures is the average payment for residents. And of course, that exceeds resident salary. And so people who say that the hospital is losing money on residents or that residents aren't a financial winner, there's multiple lines of evidence that argue strongly against that. And I guess, honestly, the strongest is probably just the empirical observation that even in the absence of a federal subsidy, if you're at a program that's capped, those programs have continued to grow. They've continued to add positions. And that's just not really what money-savvy hospitals do if they're losing money on something, is let's grow it bigger and let's grow it bigger and let's have more of this thing that we're losing money with. That doesn't make sense.
I want to pivot from talking about salaries to what the report actually puts up as what residents have had to turn to. And they say because of all the mistreatment and because of these low wages, many residents have turned to unionization. And we know that there's been a dramatic increase in the number of residents in unions across the United States. Does the rapid growth of these resident unions actually suggest that the system is more responsive than the COJ report claims, or is this just activism through a different channel?
Yeah, that's an interesting part of the report, because you're right. The tone in the report sort of regards that as a problem. Like, it's all these reasons that the match is bad, and there's a lot of reasons the match is bad, and one of them is that residents are unionizing. Certainly, that's not something we want. There's a lot I could say about this. The way I see it is sometimes, actually, I guess I'll try to link it to the discussion we were having before about what is a resident worth. And sometimes people get upset, and they say, my hospital is taking in, let's say, $150,000 in CMS payments for my position, and I'm getting paid $80,000. That's unfair. And certainly that sounds unfair. But that's not really how we value things in our economy, is by how much profit it enables. You could make similar arguments to people who, I don't know, the lowest paid job for something on an airplane, for instance, it's still a necessary job. And so you could say, well, this job, it enables all these funding streams, and therefore this person should be paid more. And in a sort of a moral sense, that I think that argument resonates. But in an economic sense, that person is going to be paid what it would cost to replace them. And if I can find someone else who can do that job just as well as them for a lower price, then I would. And that's how we determine your wage, right? And that's the problem that residents have, is that once you've been trained, once you finish your residency, you have a lot of skills that are very valuable in the market. But when you start residency on day one, you're very replaceable. And I mean that it should be obvious to you that there is a line of people behind you that would have liked to have that position that you have. And this is true for almost any residency position. And you're very replaceable. And so you're not going to earn very much in that economic sense, just like you wouldn't somewhere else. Having a nanny might allow you to work outside the home and make a large salary, but that doesn't mean that your nanny is going to make the same as your salary. It means your nanny's going to make whatever it would cost you to get a similar replacement nanny. That's the logic. So the way that workers in any industry, workers who are individually replaceable, but collectively are very, very valuable, the way that they negotiate is collectively. They form unions. An individual coal miner is very replaceable. But if all the coal miners quit, then the mine can't operate. And the owners are really hurting at that point. And this is how people who clean hotel rooms, or people who work on the assembly line, or people who work at the docks, or people who do jobs that are, their job is necessary and it contributes value to society, but at the same time, on an individual level, they're all replaceable. I think that unionization is a natural consequence of the labor market, the actual labor market that residents work in, where when they start, when they take their position, I mean, despite their impressive qualifications, sort of in an absolute sense, they're individually easily replaceable. And the way that they get better benefits, the way they get better salaries, is by acting collectively.
Yeah, I think one of the funny parts of the report is they insinuate that if we did away with the match, residents would negotiate their salaries. And I don't think I would have the confidence to beg my now program director for more money. Like that, somebody else would do the job for cheaper, and then I would be out of a job. So I thought that was
exactly hard. Yeah, it's probably time to confront that head on, because you hear this a lot. You hear, not for the match, residents, applicants would be able to negotiate better contracts, because what they'd be able to do is play offers off of one another. I got an offer from Duke. What's Stanford going to give me now? And it sort of sounds good if you remove yourself from any sort of firsthand recollection of what residency selection was like, which is applicants stuffing their CV, wordsmithing every detail, because these tiny degrees matter. You never know. One little line in your letter of recommendation, a point on the USMLE, may be the difference between you getting in and not. The idea that the average applicant is going to be able to say, hey, I'd like to come to your program, but I need to not work weekends, or I need $10,000 more. The idea that the program director is going to say anything other than, well, good luck to you, is honestly laughable. It really is laughable. No program is going to pay. Very few programs, I guess I should say, are going to pay that. And instead, because again, the fundamental thing to remember here is that we have more residency applicants than we have positions. And when you have more people who want a certain type of thing, prices for that thing, they're not going to rise. They're going to fall. You think about it in a very real sense. This year's match, you look at the numbers, it looks like probably 70%, maybe lower than that, match rate for neurosurgery, something similar, maybe a little bit better for orthopedic surgery. If you're one of the 30% of people who didn't get an orthopedic surgery position, are you going to take a pay cut so that you could get one? Yeah, you would. You want to look at all the people who were unmatched, who did not get any residency position at all. I mean, How much of a pay cut are you going to take? You want to take 75 cents on the dollar? You want to take 50 cents on the dollar? You honestly would have people offering to work for free who were kept out of the current system. They would say, I'll work for free. And that's sort of hard to argue with. And I guess I should say in this report, like I say, there's a lot of pointing at different problems, but it's unclear what problem they're primarily trying to fix.
Exactly.
But if resident salaries is the problem you're trying to fix, I don't think removing the match does it. Yeah, I think the best case scenario is that you'd see a greater spread of resident salaries. There wouldn't be quite the standardization that we have now. And it's possible that some of the biggest name institutions who are competing for the quote-unquote top applicants, they might even increase salaries. I mean, it's possible.
Doubt it.
But certainly, yeah, but certainly at the lower end of the market, where you're talking about people going unmatched or matching to a program that many people would consider undesirable, salaries are going to drop. They absolutely are going to drop. There's no way the salaries are going to rise at that level of the market.
And you had mentioned the supply and demand of residents to programs was flipped in the past, right? So pre-med,
yes,
it was flipped, and meaning we had less residents and more programs going unfilled. And so what happened, Brian,
exactly
back then with salaries then? Because that would be optimal time, pre-med
exactly
didn't exist. And it's in the favor of the trainee at that point. But resident salary did not go up, correct?
Exactly. Patrick, you hit the nail on the head. So back in the early days of the match, if you think about why the match formed and the history that led into that, the basic quick version of that story is that as hospitals expanded and the value of having physicians to take care of patients in the hospital 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that's extremely valuable service that it's hard to get in the free market with when you're talking about attending physicians. Hospitals had a strong appetite for having resident physicians. But the number of people graduating from U.S. medical schools was significantly lower than that. And this is, of course, also in a time when there weren't really pathways for international medical graduates to come to the United States. Not easy ones, not like now. That evolved in response to hospitals' appetite for residents in subsequent years. And there weren't Caribbean medical schools and things. All you had were U.S. medical schools, and there weren't enough graduates to fill all the available residency positions. And so what that meant was a certain number of hospitals were fighting to fill their spots, and the alternative was that they were going to go unfilled. And that's why hospitals began all these high pressure tactics, the take it or leave it offers, the exploding offers, things like that. But it's curious because at that time, as you said, if there were time for residents to negotiate higher salaries, that was it. There were significantly more hospitals that had a strong incentive to get a resident, any resident. And yet that's not what medical students did. And I pondered this for a while, because it seems kind of curious, because today I think that's very clearly what would happen. And I think it's just a different era. We're talking about the early 1950s and students, and we're also talking about a mindset where, like I said, the idea that residents were paid at all was somewhat a new concept. And I think there was greater acceptance of this fact that you're not really working, you're getting your training, and we just give you a living stipend. I think there was greater acceptance of that. But it showed also that students, they really wanted to get the best program. They wanted to get the best training. They wanted to go to the place that they wanted to go. That's what they prioritized. They didn't prioritize the money, even when they had the leverage to force that. And certainly, hospitals were not eager to increase their stipend. Hospitals could have competed with money and said, we don't want to go unfilled, so we're going to double our competitor's offer. And hospitals didn't do that either. Certainly the match, one of the provocative quotes you had at the beginning sort of alludes to that history, where the match was set up to keep hospitals from competing. It was to keep hospitals from competing maybe in a certain way, to keep them from having to compete on money. You could compete by getting there faster, by sealing up people sooner.
Yeah, I think that whole topic of it being a free market, if we abolish it, it's probably not what's really going to happen, right? And another aspect of the report that was really stressed was the emotional toll of the match. And we've all been through it, and it's a very stressful week. If you don't match, what that entails for your career, for your family, right? It's definitely a very big thing. But I think the report does conflate the emotional toll of going through that process, but also just being a doctor and being a resident and learning how to get through that educational time as a resident.
Yeah, you're right. There was a quote from the report, but I think it came from material they'd gotten from the AOA, the American Osteopathic Association. And it was this quote about how going through the SOAP was the worst experience of their life. And I don't doubt the truthfulness of that person's experience. It sucks. But again, like you said, does getting rid of the match fix that? I guess we might not have a SOAP anymore, but you're going to have the same number of people who win and who lose. And I think if you lose, you're going to be gutted. And you're going to be just as gutted, whether that's in the SOAP or whether, you know, all the spots that you wanted are taken by someone else for whatever reason. I think it's a property of the thing. It's not a result of the match. It's the cruel realities of a system that everybody's not going to get what they want. And that's true of the system, however you choose to assign positions.
Yeah, it'll be also interesting to see if disparities in competitive specialties and things like that, if everyone is just competing for spots on an open market per se.
Yeah, that's the thing that I think people overlook is we take it for granted that competition is a good thing. That's the premise of all this antitrust litigation is that we benefit from competition. Competitors trying to do a better job and win business and lower prices and things like that, that benefits society in general. So there's an assumption that the competition is good. But without a match, I think there's still going to be competition. And so I think what you got to ask is that the way that we want applicants to compete or not? Because right now, when residency salaries are sort of standardized programs, and I do, like I say, I think that is an anti-competitive property of the match, or that's certainly enabled by the match. It means that applicants, for better or worse, they're competing in some way on quality. Programs want the people that they perceive to be of the highest quality. And we can debate and have a vigorous debate about whether the metrics that we use are the right ones or whether they actually measure quality. But nobody's picking a resident because they think it's cheaper or because they're willing to sign a contract sooner. And that changes if you allow people to take contracts whenever they want at whatever terms that they want. And I don't think a lot of applicants are going to like that. If you actually war game it in your head and you think about, well, what's that actually going to look like if a program can offer positions outside of the match? What's that going to look like? Well, ask yourself, who you think's going to get those positions? It's going to be the person who did the away rotation. The program director is going to be like, hey, you did a good job on your rotation. I want to lock you up on the spot. Or you're from this medical school. I'm going to offer you right now. Or you're the department chair's son and I'm going to offer you right now. Is that the system that we want? Or do we want people to be able to consider their offers? The most vigorous group of students that I hear on social media are, sadly, it's the group of chronically unmatched applicants who say the match is unfair. And to them, it is unfair because it's an artificial restraint on their ability to sell their services more cheaply and be in the game instead of sitting on the sidelines. It's a system that ices them out. It's true. From their standpoint, it's an unfair system because why shouldn't they be able to sell themselves to the lowest bidder? Why not? But if you stand back and say, if you sort of get back behind the veil of ignorance and say, well, I don't know, maybe I'll be matched, maybe I won't. What's the best system? What's the fairest system? What's the system that has the best return for society? I don't think it's that. I don't think we necessarily want residents competing with each other on price. I don't think we do.
So regardless of this report and its findings, are we better off with the match, Brian, or without it?
I say we're better off with it. I guess that my thoughts on this are a little bit complicated. Sometimes when we talk about this stuff, there's a tendency to conflate the match, meaning the system through which these positions are assigned, with the match, meaning sort of everything in residency selection. And the match, as far as how residency positions, yeah, exactly. If we're talking about the match, meaning like what the NRMP does in assigning programs, I really think that's as good as it gets. It may not be as good as it gets for you as an individual. I already highlighted one example of, like I said, if you're chronically unmatched and you're willing to work for $10,000 a year, the match keeps you from being able to capitalize on that advantage that you have over other applicants. So it's not best for every given person, but on a system level, I think positions could not be allocated more efficiently. I think that's why the match algorithm got a Nobel Prize for economics. But if you're talking about residency selection, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of problems there and a lot of them demand solutions, but I don't think the solution is to get rid of the match. We have poor evaluation metrics. We have a residency system that's very inflexible and unfair. The fact that once you're in a program, that you don't have easily the ability to sort of vote with your feet and leave, I think that perpetuates a lot of resident mistreatment. It's not necessarily the assignment of the position, but it's the fact that you can't leave it easily without being significantly penalized. You know, that allows a lot of mistreatment and bad culture to persist. So yeah, I think we're better off with the match. And I think if the antitrust exemption were ever to go away, that's what the NRMP would assert. They may make some other tweaks, but they would assert that there are pro-competitive benefits of these restraints and that they're justified. And I think that courts would take that argument seriously, but whether it would prevail or not, who knows?
Yeah. I'm behind the knife. One of our episode types is we look at journal articles. And when you look at a journal article, you have the opportunity to dissect it and talk about its strengths and its weaknesses. And so to close this off, I think the report is roughly 46, 47, something along that pages. And so if you're not going to read the entire article, then you have the benefit of listening to us. I'm behind the knife, who've taken the time, and we have the expert on this, Brian, with us. But it's probably worth talking a little bit about the quality of the report. And overall, it's pretty poor. The report is really a piece of advocacy, and it's kind of dressed in the clothing of an oversight investigation. And I think it should be read that way. We've talked about a lot of extraordinarily important topics that are included within the report, but the report itself has some serious analytical and methodological problems. First of all, the evidence base is extraordinarily thin. And one of the best examples of this is the fact that the report transcribes interviews from exactly two residents. Right, two trainees, both of whom have some degree of grievances with the process. The report alleges that 1,580 documents were utilized for this from a variety of sources. If you look at the report and look at the footnotes and the citations, those documents are not in there. The exact same documents, mostly emails and other and the transcribed interviews, are the make up the corpus of the actual support for the report. They also mentioned the exact verbiage multiple times of direct evidence, right? We had direct evidence. That implies a level of investigative discovery that did not occur with this report. There are some key distinctions, too, when we talked about, and we touched on this, when it comes to salary, things like comparing a resident salary to an APP salary. It's instructive on multiple levels. And it could be used to support what may be appropriate increase in resident salary, but it ignores the greater context of physicians in training and what the bargain is when they end that training. And most importantly, I think we mentioned the word conflate. I think we said it in multiple times. The report conflates the match itself with so much else that is wrong, issues that we should continue to address in GME, things like long hours, mistreatment, depression, physician shortages, even if there are, if that is true, which is debatable too. But that all comes back on the match. And there's a lot more to this process. And Brian, you just talked about that than the match or the NRMP itself. And so if you do read the report, or if you choose not to, it's probably best understood as a prosecutor's brief, not an actual investigation per se. So hopefully that's helpful to frame the piece itself. There's so much more we could talk about in this topic. And in fact, we're going to have our COSEF team, who are one of our education team, is actually going to dive in pretty deep on the match topic and going to talk more deeply about some of these key components that we really just barely scratched the surface on today. But I do think we did our job and went through a good portion of this report and are thrilled, Brian, that you could join us today. I could really, again, highly recommend watching Brian's 6-part series on the match. Again, 20-minute videos on YouTube. We'll link them in the show notes. Highly informative. And definitely be sure to visit his blog post, thesheriffofsodium.com. Lots of really great content. I've actually already read, Brian, just last night I was reading a bunch of the articles and I really enjoyed them. Highly relevant, very practical stuff, which is fantastic. So, Dr. Carby, anything else you'd like to end with today?
Oh, man. I mean, there's lots more I could say, but I don't know how much more you want to hear from me on this topic at this point.
Well, maybe we'll be able to have you back on again, and we look forward to continuing to follow your investigation and sharing of information around the match. So, again, we really appreciate it. Thank you, Agnes and Emma, and for everyone listening, dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple, iOS, and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.